It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
It's Laurie. Johnny, are you there?
You know I am. I was letting you take the lead this time.
good morning, Hezzy. How are you?
Good morning, how are you?
We're very wet here. It's been torrential rain for the past 12 hours, and it's no sign of lighting up. Now the winds have picked up. I guess this is going to head north to you. But before I go any further, you're in for it. But before I go any further, let me say that Winston will be with us at the halfway point of the show.
Great.
He's going to call in at about 10 or 15 after. Unfortunately, our rain is also their rain up in New Hampshire, but it's ice. He said it's like the roads are like ice skating rinks. And as you know, he does snow removal in the winter times, and so he's been trying to get, you know, barrels and buckets and truckloads of sand to help people get out of their driveway, including like the United States Post Office. So anyway, he will be on, but not until halfway through the show. So here we are.
Cool. I'm so excited because you've got a fantastic vehicle to review.
It doesn't happen very often, and usually it's with Johnny, but this time I stood at the end of the driveway waving goodbye as they took away the Hyundai Santa Fe, sobbing.
Yeah.
It was absolutely splendid.
Now, I hope our readers don't get tired of it.
Can we close
Hezzy, it was a delight.
Yeah, I hope our readers don't get tired of us raving about the Hyundais, but I don't know.
I'm not offended at all. I'm thrilled that there are such vehicles that offer so much for the buck.
With Hyundai, even with their, you know, their base models and their smallest vehicle, if you asked us, you know, what we didn't like about Hyundai, you'd have a dead silence, because there's nothing we don't like. I mean, they have been almost, and I'm putting myself out on the ledge here, but of all the cars that we've driven in the past few years, they have been the most consistently best value for the money. And they, every single model that they've come out with has just gotten better and better and better. And
they didn't start out that way.
They didn't.
You used to get them when we were at the apartment. And we didn't care for them. And we said, you know, these are things that are wrong. And somewhere down the line, enough people said things, and they really took it to heart. Because if I was on a very limited budget, which we are, but if I was really on a limited budget and looking for a good quality car, I don't know how you could go much further once you looked at these, really.
Well, I wouldn't call it a limited budget as much as a set budget. I mean, you can figure this kind of...
I'd call it limited. If you don't have a lot of money, that's called limited.
Well, honey, you don't have to be a millionaire to afford, you know, the simple things in life. But what I'm saying is you could be on a fixed budget and
Are you talking about love?
What?
The simple things in life.
With you, it's not so, with
life,
you, Johnny.
Story.
With you, Johnny, it's not so simple.
What are you trying to say? And do you wonder why this show is called Driving Me Crazy? Yeah.
No, but what I'm trying to say is, just your piece of work. What I'm trying to say is that you can be on a fixed budget, and it can be a modest budget, or it could be retired people's budget like us. And still eke out enough money to certainly afford a Hyundai, almost any Hyundai. But this Hyundai Santa Fe had totally all the bells and whistles. Johnny will tell you the price after we rave about it, because you won't believe the price. I mean, this was an incredible car. Go ahead, Johnny.
Well, let me just start with this. The government gives 5-star safety ratings, as most people know. The overall vehicle score was 5 out of 5.
And we do not see that often.
No, right. No. And it, I mean, you can't, the crash or, it just, all of the things that they look for in safety, Hyundai has. And I always talk about this because I'm still fascinated. They did that commercial where there's six cars going down the road and five of the drivers get out and jump on a
flatbed
next to it, and the cars follow one another down the road and all come to the stop at the same time and the same distance from one. And that was a long time ago. It was a long time ago. And they were sort of the first. And so from a safety standpoint, and the thing I love about this car is, like, and again, a number of other cars have it, but there's certainly it works so well in this car, is you get out on the interstate or you get out on a long drive, you set the cruise control, and it literally keeps you in the center of the lane that you are in. It is monitoring both sides. You just keep your hands on the wheel. You can't take your hands off the wheel. They're getting there, but not there yet. But it literally keeps you in the center of the road. And it's monitoring the cars in front of you and will not let you run up on the back of a car, and it will not let a car stop in front of you without stopping you, whether you try to stop or not. I just, those kinds of things have to be making an imprint on the insurance groups.
Oh, sure.
Because the reduction in payouts for damages to vehicles has to be going down. The more people that are driving these kinds of cars, the lower the insurance rate should go, because they're paying less. They're paying out less. And I personally, I think that's a marvelous thing. You're keeping people alive and doing a great job. How could it get any better? I mean, it's just, that's just super. This car, fully loaded, and I'll tell you about the fully loaded stuff here in a minute, because as you know, we talked about this, that almost all the cars come now, there's very few added features. And this car has pretty much everything you would want, and it's $44,000, fully loaded. $44,000.
Three rows of seats in which you can be in the second seat and have tons of leg room, and you can even get into the third row of seats without having to cut off an appendage. I mean, it is really roomy, an amazingly roomy car, and I don't even know how they did it. One feature that I want to mention, because it was just so magnificent, is the sunroof. The sunroof, the sunroof literally goes from front to back. It exposes the entire roof line of the vehicle, and so smoothly and so seamlessly. I don't even know how they manufactured it. It is fantastic. It's almost like driving a convertible. But this car was, I could whisper sweet nothings to Johnny, who always drove when we were both in the car, because he never lets me drive anymore. Because he knows
you're driving really scares
me. Because he knows I'm a better driver than he is. But so quiet inside, easy, wonderful to handle. Does not feel like a big car. And yet, I don't even know how they did it, because, Johnny, it didn't seem like a big car when we pulled it in our garage.
No, but it's as big or bigger as than my Ford Edge.
I don't even know how to explain it. But go ahead, honey. Give the specifics.
Well, let's just talk about comfort and convenience that's included. It comes with an 8-inch touch screen, which was wonderful. And, of course, it had Sirius XM radio and all those kind of things.
Easy to program.
Yeah, easy to program. Easy to hook your phone up to. I generally always hook my phone up to the vehicles. So, and it was very easy to do those kinds of things. It's got the you just carry the key around in your pocket kind of a thing, and so you can open, lock the doors and unlock the doors, and just hands free, all of that.
But it opened the front passenger door too, which is not normal. Usually you've got a, you know, the driver opens the door with the keyless entry, and then and then you've got to punch the button inside the door. But not so with this. You could just, everything opened.
Oh, and the things, of course, that I love, especially this time of the year, heated and ventilated seats, heated steering wheel, leather seating surfaces. I mean, it's all leather inside. AM, FM, XM radio. Gosh, I'm trying to think of some things that would be unusual anymore, but there are so many of these things. The Bluetooth,
lovely panel, easy to reach controls.
Yeah, and all right at your fingertips. Oh, and when you park it, you put the push the park button, you know, and it basically locks the truck down, that kind of thing. The only things that they added was a tech package that had like high intensity lamps. Oh, that was the electronic parking brake. That was good. Dynamic bending light. That's the one when you're going around the corner. You know, the light comes on the left or on the right, and it lights up the area where you're headed. I mean, this is on a car that costs $44,000. It's just unbelievable.
The light precedes your turn. The light literally precedes your turn, so you're turning into the light. I don't even know how they do this technology.
Yeah. Well, it just comes on when you're turning and then goes off. But yeah, the fact that people think of that kind of thing, and I don't know. I really enjoy these vehicles, and I didn't cry when it left.
Well, you know,
go ahead.
So what is it about the demeanor of Hyundai that has them incorporate, you know, not only the high-end technology and the comfort level, and the structure of the car, so with all its integrity, like you mentioned, the 5-star rating, how is it that they can put it all together in one price point? And then there are other companies as well all over the place, and they have moved away from, you know, this sort of element that they bring forward, which is like this is like a price point that's affordable. For people looking for this size vehicle, and how is it that the other companies differentiate themselves from this? It seems like this is a base point, not that it's base, but it seems to be at the most required and still be technologically advanced. How do they do that?
Well, I think that
is it
the
just
one
cheaper
word
to
is...
manufacture.
Well, yeah,
maybe, but I think that the word is competition. This is a company that knows it's competing against the other Far Eastern car manufacturers, Subaru, Honda, Toyota.
Well, let me say, though, let me just say this to Hezzy's comment, and that is because we look at these things, parts and content information for the vehicle in this car line, the U.S. and Canadian parts content, 3%. Mm-hmm. Major sources of foreign parts content, Korea, 86%. It's made cheaper. Uh-huh. It's not that the materials are cheaper, I don't think. Of course, when you have a new vehicle, you don't have any history to draw on to say, "Oh, this is what it's going to be worth in 10 years." But the point is that it's cheaper to manufacture this car because it's made in a foreign country, which is what we've dealt with now for years. Why do the car companies and everybody go overseas? Because it's less expensive to make it there than it is to make it here, which is sad, but that's true. I don't know. So why does it function like it does at this price point? Because it's cheaper to make it in Korea and bring it over here and sell it than it is to make it in this country, or them to make cars like this in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish so.
We just wish it wasn't so.
Well, this vehicle evidently defines itself for what it is, and so how is it that other companies differentiate themselves from this price point and what it incorporates and charge more, even though their costs may be greater, of course? Are we going to lose our manufacturing capacity for vehicles at this rate if we keep going?
Yes.
Because there are companies leaving the United States, and there are companies coming in. That's the thing that's really exciting.
Well, I didn't even read it, but I just glanced a headline before we went live that said that Ford has just issued very low fourth quarter earnings. I don't know anything more than what I said. But another thing to think about to answer to the point of what you're saying, Hezzy, is that many of these other car companies will come out with a great base price. But then they've got options package extras that, you know, can add, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $18,000 to the bottom line.
Well, if you look at the car commercials, and Lori and I, of course, now are a lot more cognizant of this kind of thing, but you look at some of the car commercials, and it'll say, da-da-da-da-da-da car, and it starts at $13,000. And then you look real quick at the fine print at the bottom, it says model shown is like $37,000. You know what I mean? They do it quick, but this one you're seeing on TV is like, man, this is out of this world. And the base price is like, you know, $20,000. But then
they do that with everything.
Yeah. Oh, hey, Wynn.
Yes. Yeah. We're there.
Good day. How is everyone?
Good day.
We're good. Good
to have you back.
How was your ice skating adventure this morning?
Oh, I tell you, you know, there's nothing better than just going out for a quick skate first thing in the morning in a one-ton truck. I tell you, it's a, it's a beautiful thing. Magical.
Yeah.
Sonia Henny all over again on four wheels.
No, I was on six, but, you know,
great.
It's okay. You know, it's just it's all about playing the throttle sometimes. If you use your steering wheel too much, it'll actually kick the back end out. At least that's what I found.
Well, Wynn, we're happy that you've joined us. We were just talking about Hyundai, which always comes out with a class act at a low price. And the point we were discussing, which Hezzy brought up, is how come other car companies don't meet that? How come they come out with an MSRP that's low and then they add 10 or 15 grand options on top?
Yeah, but just like John was saying, you know, by the time you do put in, you know, the options that you want, it bumps the price up considerably. I mean, yeah, it's great to have a low-priced vehicle, no matter who makes it, because that gives people who can't afford a $40,000 car, $50,000 car, you know, they can only afford a $20,000, $22,000, maybe even less, $13,000, $15,000, $18,000. Mm. You know, it gives them the option to actually go out and buy themselves a new car and feel good about themselves rather than riding around in a beat-up jalopy with duct tape that holds the window up. You know, it's just it's nice. But, you know, there are, you know, other car companies do, some others do make a economy-priced car. You just, you know, you got to look for them. You're not going to have a Hummer H1, that's for sure.
I guess the thing that defines all the different vehicles at different price points is that they do have certain other qualities to them, don't they? Either it's like the driving experience or, you know, like technology to technology, they may all be at the same point. You know, I wonder, like, if in a Fiat, you could have an 8-inch screen and a 5-inch screen is fine. You know, I mean, you know, it's about where you are. I guess, you know.
Yeah, I guess it's where you are in life. I mean, I would dissuade anybody who is chomping at the bit to spend their money that they don't have on a new car. You know, it's like, well, look, you know, you don't have the money for this $30,000 vehicle. Why don't you just go out and buy a used vehicle for $10,000? It'll last you 2, 3, maybe even 4 years. It's old enough where the repairs are going to be minimal expense. And, you know, when you're done with it, discard it, make some money on scrap, save your pennies that you are saving on either, you know, your monthly payment or what have you, to put towards that new vehicle when you can. You know, you got to plan ahead on a lot of things. Otherwise, you're going to shortchange yourself and find it missing one morning because
you know,
the repo company came and knocked on your door.
When you drive a new car out of a dealership, it depreciates the minute you cross onto the road by 20 or 25%.
Yeah, which is great.
Even more.
Yep.
You know, that's number one. Number two, one thing that Johnny and I have been kind of waiting on, you know, Johnny drives a Ford Edge, and he's had it for a number of years, and it's just a fabulous car. The only thing it lacks is it doesn't have, you know, some of these, you know, new innovations. And
all the safety features that are on the new ones.
And so we thought, well, we'll trade up or, you know, whatever. And get a car that has all these features. But I'll tell you, these features are changing almost, you know, they're certainly changing with every new model season, but they're just changing all the time. There's always something coming along the pike that's that much better, that much newer, that much safer. So, you know, when do you draw the line? When do you say, yeah, I want to invest in a car that's going to last me a long time?
You got to bite the bullet. You got to bite the bullet eventually. Because, you know, like even when you get a computer, it's already 6 months out of whack. It's old, even though it's new.
That's crazy stuff. You know, I don't know. I think I have a problem with the idea that, you know, you lose so much money on cars and stuff when you buy them. But, you know, what are you going to do if you want a new car? That's just the way it is, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I do have a little bit of, you know, I love all the new technology and all the new stuff that they've stuffed into these new cars, and how much more it makes the driving experience that, you know, easier, more luxurious, kind of very fun, you know. But
yeah,
I don't know. Maybe it's the purist in me. I guess I could use that word. there's something about just running down the road with nothing to worry about except for the heat and the radio. You know, everything else kind of. What do you use the most? You use the HVAC system and the radio. You know, who cares if there's buttons on the back of the steering wheel or the cruise control in the front of the steering wheel, or, you know, that you push the button gently to engage forward or reverse. You know, it's like sometimes it's just to get out there in the purest fashion of driving. And I was even talking to Lori 2 days
Mom?
Ago about, yeah, the mother dearest, darling, yes.
That woman.
That woman over there, she birthed me. We were talking about the old FJ40 Toyota Land Cruiser that my parents had when I was a kid, and you know how much fun it would be to have one of those again. And it's going to shake your teeth out of your head. It's going to, you know, you're going to rock it down the road, crawl over everything God's green earth has to offer for you. And no, you don't have, you know, adjustable lumbar support, you know, 57 different way power seats. You've got a radio maybe, and a heating system. And a stick shift. You know, you don't. Sometimes it's best to look at the practical side.
You're a man after my own heart. I'm thinking, you know, maybe instead of all these vehicles, maybe I should return to the good old days of yore. You know, in the Amish country, you know, horse and buggy. That's my speed.
Well, you know, it's funny, Hezzy, because thinking about the days of yore. Remember how we talked about the Volkswagen microbus coming back into the United States. Well, apparently, Volkswagen is going to be investing $800 million into the U.S. Into building a new facility and building these new microbus electric vehicles in the United States.
Fantastic
news. I mean, it really took off here, and now it's going to come back here. And I really hope the market just thunders with this one, because it's such a cool, nifty vehicle.
And it will have a market. But my point, which we were talking about earlier, is that there's a price point where people are like, gosh, that's a wonderful car, but I'm not paying that much for it.
Yeah, but you know what? I agree. There are going to be some people that say that. But where this thing is, you know, not to wind the clock too far back, but remember, this thing is going to have like a 300 and some odd mile trip on a charge. It's not going to be, you're going to go from here to Duncan, and then you're going to have to plug in while you have your latte, and then you're going to have to go to work and then plug in while you're at work so that you can get back to Duncan to get back to home. It's going to be, you know, 350, 370 mile round trip distance. I think it's going to be something that's going to be fantastic, especially on the West Coast. Or anywhere that electric cars are going to take off, any mecca centers, and the charging stations are blooming up everywhere around the U.S. So that's really good news.
Yeah, I'm with you. That'd be cool.
But here's something that's just as entertaining. I got to look at the clock because I know I kicked in kind of late here. Okay.
First of all, back to the Toyota Land Cruiser, the one we had when you were a kid.
Yeah.
And it had no options. It didn't even have a suspension.
It had a suspension. No. It just didn't feel like it.
That's right. Number one. Really quick.
Yeah. Yeah.
About your cousin Max. You were talking about you drive a new car off the lot. You don't have to worry about it. His fiance bought a new Volkswagen, and apparently, cars are using some kind. I don't know I can't remember what Aunt Cindy said.
I wouldn't go into that story. I know exactly what you're talking about. But that has to do with where he lives.
About soy products were used inside some tubing in the engine? And
no, it has to do with the wiring. The Volkswagen's using a soy-based, some kind of soy-based plastic for their wire coatings. And Max lives close to the ocean, and they have some rodent problems, and the rodents found the vehicle because of the smell of the wiring and decided to eat the wiring out of the car.
Yeah.
So that's a concern.
Beg stop. She's had the car 6 weeks. So it gets towed and goes to get repaired, and they give her a loaner. There's another car that, unbeknownst to her, has the same kind of wiring coating. And so she goes into, like, the Walmart or something. She comes back, and the front seat and back seat of the car are all eaten up and torn up. And she didn't realize, but she had been there was a rat in the car that had gone nuts. And she had been driving with this rat in this loaner car. I mean, so maybe the soy-based wiring coating isn't really the smartest thing. And my point is, you can't necessarily drive a new car off the lot and have it dependably work, you know, under all circumstances. Okay, I finished my tirade. Go ahead.
That was great. Thank you. Yes, that was.
Okay, go ahead.
It has nothing to do with what I was going to talk about, but it's okay. We'll carry on.
Why do you think they call this show Driving Me Crazy? That's all
I know, right? Yeah, there's a hub here that does that, yeah. Mm-hmm. So one of the cool things that I really wanted to mention here in the time frame I've got is that Ford and Volkswagen are going to be forming a global alliance. Now, this is really cool, okay?
Wow.
Now, and it's cool in more than one way. It's kind of an in-depth thing, okay? Ford's going to be contributing to Volkswagen, and Volkswagen's going to be contributing to Ford. That's, you know, obviously what an alliance would be. But where Ford's coming out with their new Ranger, okay? The Ranger is going to be fantastic. I've looked at this. It looks like it's really going to be fantastic to have a Ford Ranger back on the roads again for that mid-sized market, okay?
Yeah.
Well, they're going to help Volkswagen manufacture their own pickup truck, which I can't wait to see what it's going to look like.
Yeah.
But that's in the wind. So we'll see how that works. It's not going to be a re-logoed Ranger at all. It's going to be something completely different. So at least that's what they say. Now,
that'll be cool.
Yeah, I think that's going to be great. But the other thing is that, see, these panel vans, okay, that you see everywhere. I mean, FedEx has taken on with them. A lot of shipping companies, florists, they're all using them. They have small ones. They have big ones. Well, they've decided that with this new merger that Volkswagen's going to start manufacturing the small ones or contributing heavily towards the distribution of those small ones. And Ford's going to be doing the big ones because Ford's good at making trucks. Volkswagen, they don't have a lot of experience and wherewithal as far as trucks go. Ford, however, is, you know, one of the top kings. So this should be a very exciting thing to see how it comes about in the very short years to come. They say that 2022 they're going to come out with a midsize Ranger. So that's really great news. On the hot side of things to do with Ford, though, and I have to mention this, I mean, I know I'm darting around a little bit, but I only have a few minutes, is that they're coming out with the Shelby Mustang GT500, and I don't know, I don't have cable, so I don't know if there's commercials out there. It's boasting 700 horsepower.
Wow.
That's going to be a mean vehicle.
We had the, Challenger or the Charger or one of those things, and you start it up and it starts down the driveway by itself. You just sort of sit there and it's. Yeah, when you start getting that kind of horsepower, it just sort of moves on its own. You really need to be on top of things.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the Shelby, if you point it in the right direction, has enough power to take you to the moon.
Mm. Well, I don't know about that.
Going back to what you were mentioning before, I read also that BMW is helping Toyota come out with a new Supra vehicle.
Really?
But they're going to be different. They're going to be different from one another. But the engineering is coming out of a BMW. But is this where we're going? Is everyone going to be working together? Cross pollinating, so to speak.
Well, it seems that it may be going in that direction. Yeah, I mean, I can't say for certain. But one of the benefits here of having an alliance, two of these companies having a really great alliance, is that it cuts down on the research and development side of things. At least hopefully this will do that. And by doing that, of course, the cost of manufacturing boils down a little bit, so it's not as bad. Maybe, and what I'm thinking is that we, the consumers, will hopefully see some of that savings in the price tags. And the, and going back to the Hyundai, you know, they're coming out with low-priced vehicles. Maybe this is a step in that direction for the bigger car companies to say, okay, we're spending a ton of money here on all this research and development. We're going to take out the cars that we don't want to sell anymore. We're going to carry those on. We're going to keep them here until these new SUVs and other things that we want to take the place of are really taking a foothold, and then kind of cancel those old ones out. Because a lot of people are really gracing more towards that SUV. And where SUV development and engine development has gotten into the point where, yes, you're getting similar mileage as you would with a Flex or something to that effect. You know, you're going to get 35 miles to the gallon in this and that. You know,
Your mom, we read an article the other day. In fact, she sent it to me. It was on the internet kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a study of the best-selling vehicles. And
we're
not talking about models and that kind of thing. It just said the best-selling vehicles. And it listed, I think it was 20, the top 20 best-selling vehicles. 60%, literally, is either 60 or 70%. It was either 14 or something, 15, 14 or 15, were what we would call crossovers, like my Ford Edge or the Hyundai Santa Fe. They were 60 or 70% of all the cars that are best-selling are these kinds of cars, just what you're talking about.
Exactly.
And so it's not that they want to get rid of models. These models aren't selling. They're going to go to the things that people buy. And another, which I thought was really interesting on the internet, said that in 10 years or so, it will be mostly all electric cars. So
maybe.
I'm not sure about that, though. Well, I think we're on the cutting edge still of that kind of thing. So.
Well, we can talk about that next week.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure we've run out of time by now. I'm not even looking at the clock.
No, it's 10:32. Hezzy, thank you so much. I have a list of things I'd like to talk about next week. I'm sorry I was late today.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That'd be good.
We got more
next
cars.
Next week we're doing the Forester, right?
Yeah.
The Subaru. We have the Subaru.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have a lot of interesting things to say about it.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Okay.
All right, everybody. Well, thank you so much. Be safe out there.
All the best. Stay dry.
Thanks, Hezzy.
Warm.
Hezzy,
bye.
See you later.
Thank you.
Take care of yourself.
Bye-bye.
You too. Goodbye. Boy, how exciting it is all about life, but it's really all about cars. Or is it all about life? I'm not quite sure. But the nice thing about John and Lori and Wynn is that they married all together. So I guess that's the name of the game. It's marriage. So... So that's his story. Well, we have a moment to take a quick break, find out what's going on in our neck of the woods. Let's find out what they're saying at the Cabot Creamery, and we'll be back. Well, let's see. Oh, well, for some reason, that's not moving ahead, so we're going to find out why in a moment. And let's just quickly look. But it should be working, but somehow the commercial is not taking on. No problem. Okay. All right, so it looks like we are on, I think. It seems that we are, so that's fine. Let me just check one more thing, and let me just try this again. And you know what we'll do? Maybe it's a different commercial. We'll find out in a moment.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a stenopad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914 562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Well, let's look what's going on in our world stage. Interestingly enough, Pelosi is barring Trump from delivering the State of the Speech, the State of the Union speech. So U.S. President Donald Trump intensified his war of words with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on Wednesday, that was yesterday, after she effectively blocked him from delivering his annual speech and annual address in Congress during the government shutdown, now in the 33rd day. So the growing acrimony came on the eve of a pair of U.S. Senate votes that appear unlikely to end the longest ever shutdown. And as furloughed federal workers vented their fury on Capitol Hill, the president and his Republicans still have the better part of a week to resolve differences with Democrats and get federal operations going back again, allowing his State of the Union speech to proceed. But the prospects were dim in the Senate votes, one on Trump's plan that includes money for the border wall, the other by Democrats seeking to reopen government before negotiating border security, bound to fail on Thursday. So traditionally, the president's annual speech is scheduled for next Tuesday, is delivered before a joint session of Congress in the ornate chamber of the House of Representatives, in an effort to force the hand of Pelosi, who had already urged Trump to reschedule due to shutdown-related security shortcomings. The president wrote to her saying it would be so very sad for our country if the State of the Union were not directed or delivered, rather, on time, on schedule, and very importantly, on location. Well, Pelosi, who has become the face of Democratic opposition to Trump in Congress, pushed back, informing the president that the House would not authorize the speech in the chamber. Again, I look forward to welcoming you to the House on a mutually agreeable date for this address when government has been reopened, said Pelosi. The rejection sent Washington's establishment into uncharted territory and all but forced Trump to retreat over his address. The State of the Union speech has been canceled by Nancy Pelosi because she doesn't want to hear the truth, quote-unquote, about border security, Trump told reporters, adding that he is considering an alternative for the speech. We'll be announcing what we'll do, he said. And the shutdown, which has seen some 800,000 federal employees left without pay for a month, was triggered by Trump's refusal to sign funding bills in December. Now, this was in retaliation for the Democrats' refusal to approve funds for extending walls along the U.S.-Mexican border. So with the closure of about one quarter of federal agencies affecting millions of Americans, hundreds of government workers who have not been paid in weeks used the power to publicize their plight, peacefully occupying a congressional office building for several hours. And some held posters on water plates, on paper plates, with messages including "We'll work for pay" and "Do your job so Americans can do theirs." And with no solution in sight, they were bracing for Friday when they expect to miss their second paycheck in a row. And Trump says he will not reopen government before his wall funding comes through. But he also pointed the finger at Pelosi and her caucus. It's really a shame, he says, what's happening with the Democrats. They've become radicalized. So the votes in the Republican-controlled Senate have the potential to break the impasse, but since both need to clear a 60-vote threshold to advance in the 100-member chamber, their passage is unlikely. So government shutdowns are a disruptive political ritual that have occurred in various administrations and are almost unique to the American system. This is one of the longest on record and has left a broad swath of federal workers unpaid, among them airport security officers, FBI agents, museum workers, U.S. Coast Guard personnel. Oh, yes, of course, the Environmental Protection Agency personnel charged with monitoring toxic chemicals or other pollutants. So we're looking at like major, major concerns all over the place, which is a bit frightening all around. But, you know, it seems that these are not issues that impact those elected to government and office. So it's going to be very, very interesting exactly where all this leads, because at the end of the day, what's more important, the function of the nation, or is it the presidency and his clout? Is it the clout of the U.S. Senate? Is it the clout of the U.S. Congress? What is the driving force? So it's going to be very interesting to see how this gets remedied one way or the other, and that is the really, really big issue. So that's interesting. Now, let's see what the president has done on an international, from an international perspective. Evidently, President Trump has recognized the Venezuelan opposition leader, Guaido is his name, as the interim president. So U.S. President Donald Trump yesterday recognized Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido as the country's interim president shortly after the National Assembly had declared himself acting president. Well, Trump described hard-left President Nicolas Maduro as illegitimate and said that the National Assembly headed by Guaido is the only legitimate branch of government duly elected by the Venezuelan people. So the U.S. president's support for Guaido came shortly after the opposition leader declared himself, quote, acting president, end quote, during a mass demonstration against Maduro. Trump noted that the National Assembly had declared Maduro illegitimate and the office of the presidency therefore vacant. My God, the people of Venezuela have courageously spoken out against Maduro and his regime and demanded freedom and the rule of law, he said. Well, Trump urged other countries to follow his lead and promised, quote, to use the full weight of United States economic and diplomatic power to press for the restoration of Venezuelan democracy. Minutes later, a Canadian government official told Reuters that Canada also plans to recognize Guaido as Venezuela's new interim president, which is exactly what they did. So Ottawa spoke, and the head of the Organization of American States also on Wednesday recognized Venezuela's National Assembly leader as the country's acting president. Our congratulations to @JGuaido as acting president of #Venezuela. You have all our recognition to launch the return of democracy to the country, the Organization of American States Secretary General Luis Almagro said in a tweet. Maduro is giving the U.S. diplomat 72 hours to leave Venezuela. Responding to Trump's announcement, Maduro said he was breaking diplomatic relations with the United States. Speaking to supporters outside the Miraflores presidential palace in Caracas, socialist leader Maduro said he would give U.S. diplomatic personnel 72 hours to leave Venezuela, which is suffering from a hyperinflationary economic collapse. Well, speaking to supporters outside the Miraflores presidential palace, I read that to you just a moment ago. So the U.S. State Department said, however, that as it does not recognize Maduro as the leader, he had no authority to sever diplomatic ties. So the United States maintains diplomatic relations with Venezuela and will conduct our relations with Venezuela through the government of interim President Guaido, who has invited our mission to remain in Venezuela, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said in a statement. So the government of Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, Peru, Guatemala, and Paraguay also declared their support for Guaido on Wednesday. This is like monumental. It's amazing the power and the clout of all these different countries coming to bear. They've had enough with Maduro. So members of the Lima Group regional bloc later issued a joint statement endorsing Guaido as interim president. Mexico, which has maintained a principle of non-intervention under leftist President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, was not among the letter's signatories, however, saying it would not take sides while branding support for Guaido a violation of sovereignty. Regional allies Cuba and Bolivia made clear that their continued support for Maduro, with Bolivian President Evo Morales condemning what he called the clause of imperialism, quote-unquote,
interfering in Latin American politics. The European Union, meanwhile, called for free and credible elections, end quote, to be held in the country. The people of Venezuela have massively called for democracy and the possibility for to freely determine their own destiny, said the European Union's diplomatic chief, Federica Mogherini, who stated that in a statement on behalf of the 28-member bloc. So the dramatic developments came as protesters took to the streets in Venezuela, answering an opposition call to fill streets nationwide in an appeal to the military and the poor to shift loyalties that until recently looked solidly behind Maduro's socialist government, clogged avenues in eastern Caracas, chanting, "Get out Maduro," and "Guaido Presidente," while waving national flags, and police fired tear gas to disperse protesters in several areas. Addressing the crowd, Guaido accused Maduro of usurping power. He promised to create a transitional government that would help the country escape its hyperinflationary economic collapse. "I swear to assume all the powers of the presidency to secure an end to the usurpation," he said. He's 35 years old, an exuberant crowd pleaser, that's for sure. And the protests were called to conclude and coincide with a historic date for Venezuelans, the anniversary of the 1958 coup that overthrew the military dictator Marcos Perez Jimenez. A small number of government supporters also marched in downtown Caracas in a rival show of strength. So the competing demonstrations come after a whirlwind week that saw an uprising by a tiny military unit, fires set during protests in poor neighborhoods, and the brief detention by security forces of the newly installed head of the opposition-controlled Congress. So four people were killed in clashes overnight on Wednesday, ahead of the demonstrations, according to police and a non-governmental organization. And for much of the past 2 years, following a deadly crackdown on protests in 2017 and the failure of negotiations ahead of last May's boycotted presidential election, the coalition of opposition parties has been badly divided by strategy and ego battles as millions of desperate Venezuelans fled the country's hyperinflation and widespread food shortages, but were buoyed by unprecedented international criticism of Maduro. Anti-government forces have put aside their differences and are projecting a united front. The government has accused the opposition of inciting violence with the aim of provoking a bloodbath. And top socialist leaders have threatened to unleash on demonstrators menacing motorcycle gangs of pro-government diehards known as colectivos. "I demand the full rigor of the law against the fascist," Maduro said on Tuesday night, while blaming terrorists, quote-unquote, allegedly linked to Guaido's Bueller Will Party for a fire at a cultural center named for a pro-government lawmaker murdered in 2014. Maduro also accused U.S. Vice President Mike Pence of trying to foment unrest after Pence released a video pledging support in Spanish for the planned demonstrations. "Though intimidation has worked for the government in the past, it may not this time," said Demetrius Pantulas, a Caracas-based political analyst. And discontent now appears to be more widespread, and the ranks of security forces and government allied groups have been thinned by the mass exodus of mostly young Venezuelans. He said the government is resorting to old tricks, but the people no longer believe them, Antulas had said. A mind-boggling situation. I wanted you to be aware of all of this in case you were unfamiliar with it, but it is a very, very important part of the northern and southern hemisphere. Venezuela is, we still buy about 500,000 barrels a day from Venezuela, but with prices being reduced from a one-time rate of about $85 or so, it's now been reduced to about $60. They are languishing, and because of a lack of funding, there's been an inability to import foods, medicines, and also the hyperinflation has caused everything to literally disintegrate in the country, and people are
flocking out of the country, crossing borders into Brazil. The Brazilian army was called up against to protect the borders, but everybody that left from Venezuela was permitted entry into Brazil. It is a mind-boggling exodus of something we have never seen, despite all the history that goes on in South America. This has been literally unbelievable and unique. So that seems to be the story. Now, there's other stuff that's going on, which are also mind-boggling on many, many levels. The United States and China are miles and miles apart from resolving the trade conflict, so says a U.S. official. We're talking about the U.S. official being U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who today mentioned that Washington and Beijing are miles and miles apart from resolving their trade war. So a high-level Chinese delegation is due in Washington next week as both sides work to reach a resolution ahead of the March 1, when U.S. duty rates on Chinese imports are due to rise sharply. So there's been a lot of anticipatory work done, but we're miles and miles from getting a resolution, and that shouldn't be too surprising, Ross told CNBC. Wall Street futures suddenly fell during his remarks, which came a day after the White House had moved to rebut media reports that the China trade talks had hit serious obstacles. While much work remained to be done, Ross added there was still, quote, a fair chance, unquote, of reaching a deal, while noting that the dispute involved issues that were difficult to address in a short time frame. I believe China would like to make a deal. I believe we would like to make a deal, but it has to be a deal that works for both parties, he said. I'm trying to say that people shouldn't think the events of next week will be a resolution and a solution to all of the issues between the United States and China. Washington and Beijing, since last year, have exchanged tit-for-tat tariffs on more than $360 billion in two-way trade, putting downward pressure on the Chinese economy while growth is slowing. And Washington accuses Beijing of a host of alleged unfair trading practices, including massive state intervention in markets and industry and the theft of American technological know-how. You know, I don't know how best to resolve this, but one thing is for sure, this is a very, very important issue. It's been allowed to languish, and it has gone in a deleterious manner against the United States. The attitude by the president is completely different than past presidencies, and maybe this is the way, the only way to get these issues resolved. So despite all the criticism, you know, of the president and of conduct and so on, I think that the U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross seems to be on the right foot because we need to resolve these issues. I don't know if the right way is this trade war and the tariff war, but, you know, what do I know? I don't have all that much information. Let's face it, at the end of the day, the president does, and there are many, many powerful people with great influence that have an understanding that makes it work. So there's an understanding that we don't always have. So that's really, really totally important to me as far as I could see it. Well, there are a lot of other things that are going on around the world. And one of the most interesting, of course, is what the Pope has to say. The Pope says that the migration fears, quote, are making us crazy on his trip to Panama. Well, Pope Francis said Wednesday that fear of migration is making us crazy, quote unquote, as he began a trip to Central America amid a standoff over President Donald Trump's promised wall at the U.S.-Mexico border and a new caravan of migrants heading north. Pope Francis was asked by reporters about the proposed border wall Wednesday on the way to Panama, where he is looking to leave the sex abuse scandals buffeting his papacy behind. That's what so Francis responded, it is the fear that makes us crazy, quote unquote. The pontiff's plane touched down in Panama City. in the afternoon, and he was met by President Juan Carlos Varela and First Lady Lorena Castillo. They both escorted him along a red carpet laid on the tarmac. Now, spectators waved Panamanian flags in greeting and shouted, "This is the youth of the Pope." After a brief welcoming ceremony, he was driven away from the airport and did not have any more activities scheduled for the evening. Francis landed as Venezuela's protracted political crisis flared up, with the opposition president of the country's National Assembly declaring himself interim president, and a number of regional countries, including the United States and Canada, recognizing him. The Vatican had said previously that the Pope would refrain from making explicit reference to Venezuela while in Panama, but the developments ensured he would face questions about the South American nation during the trip. Roman Catholic Church's first Latin American Pope and the son of Italian immigrants to Argentina, Francis has made the plight of migrants and refugees a cornerstone of his papacy. He is also expected to offer words of encouragement to young people gathered in Panama for World Youth Day, the church's once every 3-year rally that aims to invigorate the next generation of Catholics in their faith. Panama Archbishop Jose Domingo Ulloa said that Francis' message is likely to resonate with young Central Americans who see their only future free of violence and poverty in migrating to the United States. Quote, "Young people who often fall into the hands of drug traffickers and so many other realities that our young people face," end quote. So the Pope is expected to urge young people to create their own opportunities while calling on governments to do their share as well. The visit is taking place as the United States government remains partly shut down in the standoff between the Trump administration and Democrats over funding for Trump's promised border wall. Francis famously has called for, quote, "bridges, not walls," quote, unquote, after celebrating Mass in 2016 on the Mexican side of the U.S. border. He denounced anyone who wants to build a wall to keep out migrants as not Christian, quote, unquote. Now, crowds are expected to be smaller than usual for this World Youth Day. Only about 150,000 people had registered as of last week, but thousands more will certainly throng Francis's main events, which include a vigil with a final Mass on Sunday. The Vatican conceded that the January date doesn't suit school vacations in Europe or North America, both of which typically send huge numbers of pilgrims to World Youth Day gatherings. Francis' trip, the first in a year packed with foreign travel, comes at a critical moment in the papacy as the Catholic hierarchy globally is facing a crisis in credibility for covering up decades of cases of priests molesting young people. Pope is expected to soon rule on the fate of former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, the high-powered U.S. archbishop accused of molesting minors and adults, and he is hosting church leaders at the Vatican next month on trying to chart a way forward for the global church. Vatican spokesman Alessandro Bisotti said there were no plans for Francis to meet with abuse survivors in Panama. Central America hasn't yet seen the explosion of sex abuse cases that have shattered trust in the Catholic hierarchy in Chile, the United States, and other parts of the world. This is the first papal visit to Panama since St. John Paul II was there during a 1983 regional tour that famously included an unscheduled stop at the tomb of Archbishop Oscar Romero in El Salvador. Romero had been gunned down, if you remember, by right-wing death squads 3 years earlier at the start of El Salvador's civil war for having spoken out on behalf of the poor. Salvadoran bishops had hoped Francis would follow suit and make a stop in El Salvador this time to pay his respects at Romero's tomb since Francis canonized him in October. But the Vatican said a Salvador leg was never really in the cards. Nevertheless, Bisotti said Romero would likely loom large at the Panama gathering, given he is such a point of reference for young Central American Catholics who grew up learning about his defense of the poor. The Panama visit is also the first by a pope since the Vatican Embassy played a crucial role during the 1989 U.S. invasion of Panama, when dictator Manuel Noriega took refuge there and requested asylum on Christmas Eve after 4 days on the run trying to escape U.S. troops. Noriega eventually surrendered, bringing to an end one of the more unusual U.S. military operations. It involved U.S. troops blasting heavy metal and rock music, including Van Halen's Panama, at the embassy to try to force Noriega out. Noriega, a one-time U.S. ally, eventually served a 17-year drug sentence in the United States. He died in 2017 after his final years were spent in a Panamanian prison for the murder of political opponents during the 1983 to 1989 regime. Pope Francis confirmed to reporters aboard the plans to go to Japan in November. The Pope also said he wants to visit Iraq, but that local church leaders have told him that the security situation is not yet right. This year, the pontiff has already scheduled trips to the United Arab Emirates, Morocco, and Bulgaria, and Macedonia, and a trip to Madagascar is rumored. It is absolutely mind-boggling, the stamina, the will, the drive of this pope. It is absolutely breathtaking to see such exuberance. It's almost a tearjerker. It really is unbelievable. You don't have to be Christian to recognize this. It is absolutely mind-boggling. And that he's willing to meet with all these challenges on a worldwide basis is astronomical in its integrity and its capacity to literally influence by his very being. It's just amazing. So, you know, whether you believe or you don't, evidently what is interesting is that this pope, evidently probably better than any other, maybe it is because of the days of modernity, but he's able to somehow generate sense of Jesus that people look to him for guidance for. So the Christ that is the belief of the Christian church is simply that, an embodiment of this particular pope. But what's fascinating is he eclipses even his own religious body, so that he has impact way beyond even the church, which is astronomical in its ability and its capacity. But I think it has so much to do with who this pope is. His humanity is just so, he wears it on his sleeve. You cannot not recognize it. It is so powerful, unbelievable. And let's face it, he inherited so much of the past abuses that took place throughout the church, his legacy of child molestation and abuse of even young people and adults. I don't know how well that's going. I can't judge that. But there are a lot of cases that are coming to the forefront. So we'll see exactly where that ends up, which is fascinating to say the least. Now let's try again. It doesn't look like, for some reason, Cabot Creamery ad hasn't been resuscitated. We'll find out what goes on there. Maybe it works this time. We'll try one more time.
Hey, you a judge?
Sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do.
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste White Cabot's one every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Well, welcome back. Bear with me 1 second. This is, I think this is quite interesting. This took place a couple of days ago. Evidently, the Emir of Qatar was in Beirut for an Arab Economic Summit. So Qatar's ruler arrived at the Arab Economic and Social Development Summit as the regional bloc debates Syria's readmission. Lebanese President Michel Aoun also urged world powers to step up efforts to help Syrian refugees return home. Now, Qatar's Emir, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, has arrived in Beirut to attend an Arab economic summit marred by divisions over readmitting Syria into the Arab League. Now, Qatar's government has been one of the main backers of Syrian insurgents who have tried since the beginning of the civil war in 2011 to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad. So the visit by its main representative is widely seen as the first step to restoring relations with Syria. Now, last month, the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain had reopened their embassies in Damascus, a move seen as a strategic and diplomatic shift in the region. On Friday, last week, Lebanon's foreign minister, Gebran Bassil, called for the Arab League to readmit to Syria more than 7 years after Damascus's membership. Syria is the most notable absentee at the conference, and we feel the weight of its absence, Bassil had said. Syria should be among us without us having to wait for permission for it to return, and he added a meeting with other ministers from Arab League nations. This was reported, of course, in the Daily Star in Lebanon. So that became a big issue. So we'll just see where this goes. It's going to be very interesting exactly where it goes, because at the moment I have no clue. But very, very intriguing to say the least. Now, let me just look at one more thing, just see what else is happening on the world stage. Okay, and this is interesting only because it speaks to a lot of different issues. The embattled Renault boss, Carlos Ghosn, has resigned. So Renault appointed Michelin boss Jean-Dominique Senard as its new chairman today, after Carlos Ghosn was forced to resign in the wake of a financial scandal that has rocked the French carmaker and its alliance with Japan's Nissan and Mitsubishi. Senard will become a chairman immediately, the company said, with Deputy Chief Executive Thierry Bolloré taking over Ghosn's other Renault role as full CEO. The appointments may begin to ease a Renault-Nissan leadership crisis that erupted after Ghosn's November 19 arrest in Japan and swift dismissal as Nissan chairman. Senard, 65, now faces the task of soothing relations with Renault's Japanese partner and resuming talks on a new alliance structure, to cement the 20-year-old partnership. It's important that this alliance remain extremely strong, Senard told reporters after a board meeting, citing the mounting investment demands of new vehicle technologies. It is our compulsory duty to go forward together. Ghosn's exit also marks a clear end to one of the auto industry's most fated careers. 2 decades after he was dispatched by former Renault boss Louis Schweitzer to rescue newly acquired Nissan from near bankruptcy, a feat he pulled off in 2 years. After 14 years as Renault CEO and a decade as chairman, Ghosn formally resigned from both roles on the eve of the board meeting. Ghosn's arrest and indictment for financial misconduct has strained the Renault-Nissan relationship, threatening the future of the industrial partnership he transformed into a global car-making giant over 2 decades. For 2 months, the tensions deepened as Renault and the French government stuck by Gosen, despite the revelation he had arranged to be paid tens of millions of dollars in additional income unbeknownst to shareholders. Gosen has been charged with failing to disclose more than $80 million in additional compensation for 2010 to 2018 that he had agreed to be paid later. Nissan director Greg Kelly and the Japanese company itself have also been indicted. Both men deny the deferred pay was illegal or required disclosure, while not contesting the agreement's existence. Gosen has denied a separate breach of trust charge over personal investment losses he temporarily transferred to Nissan in 2008. Gosen had agreed in recent down from Renault, Reuters reported on Tuesday, but only after the French government, Renault's biggest shareholder, called for leadership change and his bail requests were rejected. Senaud, who had been due to retire from Michelin in April, now has fences to mend in Japan. Following Gosen's arrest, Nissan CEO Hirohito Saikawa had sought to weaken Renault's control and resisted its attempts to nominate new directors to the Japanese car maker's board. In a possible sign of detente, on Thursday, Nissan called an April shareholder meeting to appoint a Renault-nominated board member and formally terminate Gosen and Kelly's directorship. It remains unclear, though, whether Renault, as Nissan's parent, will also name its next chairman. Nissan currently owns a 15% non-voting stake in its French parent and a 34% in Mitsubishi Motors, a third major partner in their manufacturing alliance. Now, once its new management is settled, French officials want the alliance to resume work on a new ownership structure to cement the partnership, which Gosen had been mandated to explore when his Renault contract was renewed last year. Nissan is wary of any such move. In an interview last week, Saikawa acknowledged shareholders' concerns that the current structure undervalues their investments, but added that altering it was really not the current priority. As Renault CEO Bolloré will also become chairman of the alliance, a French official told Reuters, as set out in the 2002 shareholder pact underpinning the partnership. His operational alliance role will be overseen by Senaud, who will lead discussions on the future evolution of its structure, Renault had said. Renault has yet to finalize Gosen's severance package, estimated by the CGT union at 25 to 28 million euros, that's about $28 to $32 million, in addition to an annual pension of 800,000 euros. Gosen's golden parachute could be politically explosive in France, where the government is battling yellow vest street tests over low pay and inequality. Fabien Gache, a Renault CGT spokesman, said on Thursday the union would press the government to vote against the package at Renault's annual shareholder meeting in June. We should not add indecency to indecency, Gache had said. The government will decide how to vote on Gosen's severance pay when details become clear, a finance ministry official had advised. My God, the stuff that goes on around the world, huh? Isn't that just absolutely amazing? Well, let me just take one more quick look and see what else is going on. And I wanted to just check a couple of points because I wanted to make sure that I cover some issues. Yeah, this I think you'll find interesting only because I think you will find this interesting because of it impacts so much. Evidently, France has agreed or has hit Google with a record 50 million euro fine under the new European Union data rules. France's data watchdog on Monday announced a fine of 50 million euros, that's $57 million, for U.S. search engine giant Google. Using the European Union's strict general data protection regulation, the GDPR, for the first time. Google was handed a record fine from the CNIL regulator for failing to provide transparent and easily accessible information on the data consent policies, a spokesman statement said. The CNIL said that Google made it too difficult for users to understand and manage preferences on how their personal information is used, in particular with regards to targeting advertising. People expect high standards of transparency and control from us. We're deeply committed to meeting those expectations and the consent requirements of the GDPR, a Google spokesperson said in a statement. This is the constant BS that you hear. We intend, that's our commitment, but that doesn't mean they do it. We're studying the decision to determine our next steps. I don't know what they didn't know in the first place, that they were breaching some issues here, or so one can infer by the fine. But that doesn't mean the fine will be proven. So the ruling follows complaints lodged by two advocacy groups last May, shortly after the landmark GDPR directive came into effect. One was filed on behalf of some 10,000 signatories by France's Quadrature du Nord group, while the other was by None of Your Business, created by the Austrian privacy activist Max Schrems. Schrems had accused Google of securing, quote, forced consent, end quote, via its Android mobile operating software through the use of pop-up boxes online or on its apps, which imply that its services will not be available unless the conditions of use are accepted. Also, the information provided is not sufficiently clear for the user to understand that the legal basis for targeted advertising is consent and not Google's legitimate business interests, the CNIL said. We have found that large corporations such as Google simply interpret the law differently and have often only superficially adapted, Schrems said in a statement after the ruling, and he's right about that. It is important that the authorities make it clear that simply claiming to be compliant is not enough. Well, that's the problem. We don't have oversight. We always say that we do, but we don't. The GDPR is widely considered the biggest shakeup to data privacy regulation since the advent of the web. Even companies which are not based in Europe must follow the tough new rules if they want their sites and services to be available to European users. The CNIL found that despite changes implemented by Google since last year, it was still failing to respect the spirit of the new rules. It noted, for example, that specifics on how long a person's data is kept and what it is used for are spread across several different web pages. Modifying a user's data preferences also requires clicking through a variety of pages, such as more options, and often the choices to accept Google's terms are pre-checked by default. This type of procedure leads the user to give global consent, but the consent is not specific as the GDPR requires, the regulator said. It said the record 50 million euro fine reflected the seriousness of the failings, as well as Google's dominant market position in France via Android. Each day, thousands of French users create a Google account on their smartphone, the CNIL said. As a result, the company has a special responsibility when it comes to respecting their obligations in this domain, it said. It is not the first time the regulator has taken Google to task over its policies. In 2014, it fined the company 150,000 euros, the maximum possible at the time, for failing to comply with its privacy guidelines for personal data. And in 2016, it imposed a 100,000 euro penalty over noncompliance with the European Union's right to be forgotten rule, allowing people to request having references to them removed from search results. Google has contested the decision, saying it should apply only to its European sites such as Google France and not the global Google.com domain. Earlier this month, the Advocate General of the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg sided with Google in the case, though a final ruling has not yet been announced. So, very, very compelling news and very important on the world stage. So, now let me quickly look about one other thing. I wanted to check this with you, and bear with me a moment. One second here. I think that is actually it. Bear with me one more second. Tomorrow is the 25th. We're going to speak to Victoria Garrity tomorrow from 10 to 10:30. And so hopefully you'll be able to join us then. And we really look forward to your engaging us tomorrow. All the best. And thank you again for being with us. So let me just check. There we are. So we'll say goodbye. Thank you. Bye.